Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Listening to Let's Eat In. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. We're here at Roberta's Pizza, which is the home of Heritage Radio Network. And today's show is brought to you by TechServe. Just a quick note, TechServe is New York's premier Apple reseller and service provider. They are serving individual customers, creative professionals, and Fortune 100 companies. And TechServe has built a solid reputation on its expertise in technology, sales, and service. And as a company that believes in honest and forthright business practices, TechServe is proud to sponsor Heritage Radio Network in the promotion of sustainable lifestyles. To support sustainability in New York City, TechServe is holding an e-waste recycling drive on Saturday, April 10th, in 2 weekends from now, from 10 to 4 p.m. For more information, go to techserve.com. So that's our wonderful sponsor, and we're just so happy that they're supporting this radio station. So today, another rainy Monday in Brooklyn, the cusp of spring is definitely on the way. Actually, it's officially spring. What am I talking about? So I hope everybody had a great weekend. Everyone's having a great Passover tonight. Hope you have that brisket in the pot right now, bubbling. I don't, unfortunately. but maybe next year. There's always hope. We actually had a great dinner, or actually brunch, yesterday at Jimmy's 43. It's a wonderful beer bar in the East Village, and we had a guest chef from Copenhagen, Trina Hanman. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So Trina was a guest chef yesterday, and she served her smorgasbord of Danish delights, and she's also the author of the Scandinavian Cookbook and the Nordic Diet. Any other books am I missing here?
Not in English. They're all in Danish. So the rest
hopefully,
of them.
Hopefully soon then. And what's your catering company called again?
It's called Hanneman's Kitchen, mm-hmm. And it's based in Copenhagen.
Great. Anytime you're in Copenhagen, please look this group up. I'm sure it's going to be delightful. And everything that was served yesterday got just, I think it was amazing, but everybody seemed to really enjoy it. It was really authentic, fresh, and all the food was, you know, locally sourced as usual here. That must have been a challenge for you, though, just trying to...
Yeah, there were some few things we had to give up, but we did a really good job, Jimmy and me, figuring it out during the week. So
it always comes together.
Yeah.
And we also have Claire Harton here. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi.
Claire was kind of like the glue that put together... this event yesterday. Claire is a friend of Jimmy's as well as Trina's, and you work on the Dirt Cafe project. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
It's an interdisciplinary collaborative project that we've been doing internationally, various partners since 2004, based in London, but it's an experimental project. And then on top of that, we do other things that grow out of that, and one of them incubated and became relationships between Trina and Jimmy and me and Saxelby and all sorts of others. And we sort of, I think this just went on. and we sort of try to join up people and use the social interactions to do meaningful projects.
And it sounds like your last event went really well. And unfortunately, I couldn't make it, but I heard, you know, it was a very successful group of people that came, a lot of experts in various fields, scientists, you were saying, showed up to lend their expertise to all these great projects in the works. And who...
Well, in general, I mean, in projects, Trina and I often talk about, along with peers like Carolyn Steele, Jimmy Garboni, three people from the Urban Design Lab at Columbia University. Maria Palasuto is a scientist and design researcher at Columbia University. Michael Conard, Kubi Ackerman, lots of amazing people. And we, with chefs and restaurateurs and very hands-on frontline people that are... whether it's Davy Hughes, who runs Union Square, is one of the people who runs Union Square Green Market. We try to take the hands-on frontliners and mix them together with very serious specialists, economists, scientists, green chemists, engineers, architects, and try to really enhance the creative problem-solving process. But we think it begins with a meal, and it begins with those powerful friendships, empathy, trust, and from there we can do more things.
That's terrific. I totally agree with you. Start off with a good meal. And who doesn't want to, you know, stay motivated? Can you tell me anything in the works maybe that came out of the Last Dirt Cafe or is going on right now?
Well, we always kind of watch because it's a very private, quiet little project. And we don't do any PR. There's no publicity, any press that's involved with it are actually participants of it. So someone like a blogger, Carrie Truman, was actually a participant in it rather than there to cover it, because we hope to transform the way they do things and see things in their relationships too. But I've heard that Kate Bakewell, who's an architect, has followed up with Anne Saxelby, who's owns Saxelby Cheesemonger.
She has a show here on Sundays, Cutting the Curd.
They're stirring the idea that Anne's been dreaming about for years since I moved back from London to New York 4 years ago, and she's been talking about what a great, wonderful thing it would be for the community in the Lower East Side to transform the roof of the Lower East Side, or the Essex Market, into not only a community garden, but a composting place. So it's a big dream, it's far off, but Kate as an architect and Anne are now sort of stirring that up as a relationship, an idea.
That is really exciting. Wonderful.
Whether it goes somewhere, so, we'll see, but it started.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that top secret news. That's really cool. I can't wait to hear. I'm sure there's lots of, so there's going to be a composting, can it be a community compost?
Well,
like drop-off?
They're trying to, at this point, it's so early on, it's just them stirring the idea. They found each other. So architect and somebody has a shop in Essex Market, but from what I understand, they're going to try to put a proposal together, talk to the EDC. So there's a long distance between here and getting
it
done.
Right, sure, yeah.
But it's those powerful partnerships.
And, you know, I hear more and more whenever I have a guest or just talk to somebody that is involved in urban farming, composting comes up first and foremost. It's like the beginning stage. It's like what you need to focus on first before understanding how everything else falls in place. I've been hearing that, and I slightly surprised to hear such an emphasis on it. Trina, is composting something that is very, I don't know, more commonly done in where you live in Copenhagen, or
not for the restaurants? Yes,
for the restaurants.
Yes, but for regular households, right. We don't compost, but we have the bottles aside and the paper and all of that. But
you recycle.
I can remember that. We recycle, but we don't compost.
Yeah. It's hard because it's something that obviously needs to be collected and in order to facilitate people to actually do it.
But we do we do in restaurants, and we have done for the last 10 or 15 years. All the times I've been in this.
10 or 15
maybe
years.
Maybe more. All the times I've been in industry, we have done compost.
That's amazing. So whenever you're chopping an onion, you have the peel, you...
Yeah,
in the
we call it the pig bin.
Uh-huh.
That's what it's called. And then it's collected twice a week and taken to the farmers. So,
are you just amazed at how barbaric we are here in New York City that we don't do that for the last 10, 20 years and still going strong?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not amazed about it. I think it's if it doesn't make sense, it won't happen. And right. Now suddenly it's making sense. It has to be doable and economically wise, and there's so many things that goes into it before people can make that decision and that change.
Right. I think people need to understand why it's valuable.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Why
a century ago.
Yeah.
A century ago, we did collect it in New York, and And we got our efficiency systems up in big system cities, London, New York, for example. But I've been hearing good things, that such as Vienna is now up to 40% composting, and that's a new program. So one always thinks these things happen in places like San Francisco because of their culture and the buy-in from the political will from the mayor's level. And then I've been talking to two of our other peers and collaborators from the Dirt Cafe project, Sarah Bilney and Patricia Michelson at La Fromagerie in London. And they've been, you know, very interested in this for years. And so people are pushing from the inside.
Mm-hmm. And do you think maybe the Essex Market project will be a good model for...
Small scale all over the city, and then we also need massive scale.
Yeah.
we need them to run in tandem, the big systems for the city, and then on top of that, the little demonstrative things that each person can contribute to in neighborhoods.
That's great, yeah, because what I've been seeing is, you know, more people are farming, more people are gardening, I should say, in their backyards and wherever, and they're realizing, hey, these garden scraps and... Maybe they have chickens, and so that scraps, it all is part of that, your little ecosystem in the garden. So it's turning a lot of people on to composting, I think. Hopefully, we'll see.
Yeah.
So what else is unique to cooking in Denmark as opposed to New York City? Because I know we had a fun day yesterday, but there was a lot of, you know, there's a tiny kitchen, which is great. You know, we're happy to take over that kitchen at Jimmy's.
Yeah, we did.
We really did. And use as much of it as possible, every inch. But what, you know, I think you were telling me at one point that there's a lot more guidelines, restrictions, and just general... kitchen, I don't know, rules that you're used to in commercial.
Yeah, we have much tougher rules than you do. This both has to do with the working environment and the health and safety
of the food. Yeah,
not both the food, but also the people working there.
Yeah.
So it's in that sense, it's very different.
And it's cleaner. It's for the cleanliness overall.
Oh, it's for the cleanliness, but it's also about people who work there. You have to have daylight in the kitchen.
Yeah,
in Denmark,
yeah.
You're not allowed to work in the kitchen without daylight.
Without windows or
without
sunlight.
Without windows, sunlight. And you're not, and there's all these rules about how much room you have to have. And
per person.
Per person. And tables have to be in the right height, so they have to be adjustable.
Mm-hmm.
And
like
working hours are different. And you know, minimum wage, lots of things. But you also have to remember, I come from a little tiny country, 5 million people.
Mm-hmm.
It's so easy to control. And you know what I mean? It's doable. Everything is doable in Denmark or in Scandinavia, because we are so good models to try out new things, because small countries,
mm-hmm.
very, very accessible.
Interesting. So, okay. So tell me a little bit about your project that you mentioned. You're going to garden, and then in the city, and then in the farm, in the country.
I mean, Scandinavia seasons are very, very important still. Mm-hmm. I mean, we especially if you go to the top of if you go to the northern parts of Norway, it's really difficult to get so many things up there. So we also some parts of the Scandinavia are very excluded, but Denmark seasonality is really, really important. And, so I'm doing a project to try to see how I can grow some very exotic things in the front yard of my house, which is a tiny house in the middle of Copenhagen.
Okay.
And then my mom, she has a huge garden where she has a big vegetable garden, herb garden, and she's an amateur gardener.
Okay.
And she's gonna do we're gonna do a greenhouse, one in her garden, which would be a bit bigger than mine, and I'm going to do one in my front yard, and we're going to grow ginger, lemongrass, chilies, and tomatoes, and see how it goes and what the differences would be between urban and in the country.
Oh, that's
the farm,
amazing.
And to see what's the differences in the sunlight, what's the differences, is it hotter in the city, whatever.
Right,
all
I
these things that we will go through. Yeah, and we'll write about it, and we will film it, and this is for the whole summer.
I really can't wait to see what will happen.
Yeah.
And why did you choose these exotic?
Because they travel.
Challenge.
They travel from afar, and green to grow tomatoes in Denmark in greenhouses is really, really expensive, because we heat up the greenhouse. I mean, you have all these paradoxes in sustainability. Everybody say buy locally, but if you buy local Danish tomatoes, they actually use much more energy growing in a greenhouse than eating them from Spain that has been you know, driven up to Denmark. It's a better idea to buy organic Spanish tomatoes than to buy Danish tomatoes most of the time, unless it's in August. And they are, but all greenhouses are nowadays not warmed up with the sun. It's fuel is used.
I think that's something that's so worthy of being more aware of. You know, you don't grow cranberries in a desert, like, try to. Yeah.
But there's a lot of paradoxes you have to look into all the time, and there's not necessarily one answer. That's the whole problem. But I think for where I come from, the seasons are extremely important, and our seasons are not like 1 month or 3 months or something. We have a asparagus season. It's between 3 or 6 weeks. We have strawberry season. Some years it's 2 months. Some years it's three weeks.
Okay.
And that's it. And then the strawberries are the best in the world. So eat them when they're there. I mean,
gotta eat them now.
Yeah. So I think it plays still a very big role in our food culture.
The seasonality. Being aware of that.
Yeah.
That's great. We're just going to take a quick song break. And Trina, you picked a song. What is it?
This is a Danish band called Blue Foundation, and it's one of my favorite bands. And this is a number called Bonfire, and I really love this song.
Thanks so much. We'll be right back. And are quite all right. You wash my tears away. We're back on Let's Eat In. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. Today's show is brought to you by TechServe. Thanks so much for our Heritage Radio Network engineer, Jack, and producer, Jack, and engineer, Nat Wiener. We have Trina Hanneman and Claire Harton today on the show. And Trina, I'm looking at your book right now. I got to tell you, it's called The Scandinavian Cookbook. It's the definitive Scandinavian cookbook, and I can't think of a better looking book than this. I was flipping through it on the subway last night, and somebody was leaning over my shoulder, just gawking at it. And they were like, you have to tell me what cookbook that is. And I told them all about it, actually. I kept them sitting there. And I just can't wait to tear into these recipes. So yesterday we made a smorgasbord. What exactly is a smorgasbord? What does it have to be?
A smorgasbord is a open sandwich, and the most important part of it is a piece of rye bread. And then It has to be rye.
Any rye, you know, Jewish
Yeah, you could use, it has to be a sour, made on a sourdough, and it can't be a sweet rye bread. It has to be salty kind of rye bread.
I've never had sweet, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And on top of that, you make all these combinations with either fish or meat or just vegetables. And you have a beautiful open sandwiches. And some of the combinations we had yesterday were like marinated herring with a beetroot and apple salad with horseradish, and you
that
grated all the horseradish.
I did grate all the horseradish, and I...
Until you cried or something.
I sneezed, I cried. Yeah.
And there was a mackerel salad. There was you boiled potatoes and cut them in slices, put it on the rye bread with a herb marinade and some radishes and...
That was beautiful.
And spring onions on top. So it's... Yeah. It has a lot of rules what you can combine, but it's...
I think a lot of people like the meatball one,
oh,
too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Meatballs,
Trina,
yeah.
Can you tell the story of how... first of all, the difference between a smorgasbord and schmolbrot. Is that how you say it?
Oh, yeah, I'm looking at this
and also
recipe.
where these open-faced sandwiches came from as in the 20th century, because they're kind of a new thing.
Yeah, I mean, they... In 19th century or 18th century, people would just take to the field when they had to have a lunch with them. They would take a piece of bread, some fat, and some cold cut from the day before, or just the fat and the bread, depending on what kind of food they had. And then from that on, it grew. Cold cuts came, piece of fish from last night. And then the early 20s, 1920s, it became more elaborated. So because it goes so well with beer. So they became... you know, more elaborated with all these combinations like you saw them yesterday, because when you went to restaurants, it didn't take a long time to eat. You had one or two and you could eat it in half an hour, and that made you had more time dancing.
Oh my goodness. it goes well with beer.
Yeah.
Why did we have a brunch yesterday? Why didn't we have dinner?
So.
Well, and also, Trina, how it's sort of not brunch, it's lunch, right?
Yeah, it's
because
a lunch.
Scandinavians
don't
have brunch.
We don't have brunch. It's something the American taught us. So.
I don't have brunch either.
Oh, okay. I just wrote a book in Danish said, enough of brunch, we want lunch.
I am all about it. I am actually really eager to start focusing on lunch as my next blog concept. But I can't wait, because so you said this was kind of like a, you bring it with you when you have to go to work, this bread, and then you top it.
Yeah.
So it's a real working class meal.
Yeah,
idea, concept.
Yeah, it goes through all classes, but of course they become more elaborated the more things you put on them. And and the ones we had yesterday, you couldn't put them in a lunchbox. It would be too smushy and, you know, it wouldn't be really nice.
Yeah,
so it'd be more
You have to put it together once you're
That would be
ready.
More like just a piece of bread, some butter or fat, and then a piece of meat on top, and that's it.
Now, I've never actually tasted anything like your rye bread, and I'm looking at the recipe right now. It was... so flavorful.
Yeah.
It tasted, I could just eat that alone. It does have buttermilk in it, so it has a little fat, which is interesting. But what else about it? I know it was, I don't know, your sourdough. Is there anything particular to it?
Yeah, you have to make this your own sourdough, because that's a culture that will make your bread rise, and it will, the whole taste and everything is building on your sourdough starter. And I have one at home that's 30 years old, so I use it for all my rye bread. And the rye bread, there's also one specific thing about it, is that it's really healthy. That all that thing about we can't eat bread, it's not really true. There's lots of very unhealthy bread on very poor quality flour, but really nice quality flour. And also the rye is so healthy. There's vitamin K, there's protein, there's
from the amino acids, from the starter,
and it also has, you use the whole grain when you
that had a lot of nice grains in it too. You had like sesame seeds in there on top.
That's just to put some flavor. You could do anything. You wouldn't necessarily have to have any seeds. It's the whole rye and the rye flour, and when you do that, and it's a whole wheat. No, you don't say it's a, you use the whole rye. So When you make the flour, all the nutrition is outside on the grain, is in there, and it's what's outside the grain. That's where the nutrition
where
is,
husk,
and all the minerals and vitamins are in the husk. Is that
amazing?
So,
it tasted incredible. I mean, you've got to write a bread book next time. I hope
you have somebody actually here in New York who could talk to you at depth about it if you wanted to go into bread. And her name's Claudia Keel, and she's the head of the Traditional Food Guild, as well as a nutritional support specialist and flower essence specialist. But she knows a lot about the complexity on a healing, body healing, nutrition side. And she's also part of the whole Dirt Cafe project. But she really could tell you what's in it and how it goes through our body. And also she addresses people's rising gluten sensitivities. Right. Because a lot of people come to her with gluten sensitivities. And she tries to raise the resilience of their gut so that they can actually digest
things. But rye bread is really low in gluten, because gluten is what is in wheat, and that's what makes a kind of the dough stick together when you bake. And that's the reason why when you do rye bread, you always have to have a baking form to put the rye dough into it, because it's so runny. Yeah.
Interesting.
So, and that's because there's so little gluten in it. It's like when you do spelt as well, very little gluten there's no elasticity in the bread, and it won't stick together. So So you, and it's actually, if you do a bread just on wheat, you can rinse out the gluten in water and then try to bake it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fun thing to see what the difference is. And a gluten-free bread, it's very different in texture and
yeah,
in taste.
Definitely. Yeah. This tasted like, I'm really turning on to the sourdough now.
Yeah.
I think it sounds like the way to go. Claire, you're the best in recommending people too.
Well, gluten's fascinating too, because it's able to, because it's so elastic, it's able to capture pockets of air as you bake, and that's what makes it fluffy. Pancakes fluffy, bread fluffy. And so that bread you had yesterday that Trina, by the way, baked in Copenhagen and dragged over in her suitcase, that you can't imagine how heavy that suitcase was. I thought she'd brought over rocks for me. And when I picked up the suitcase.
Next time.
And, Trina, for the rocks.
But she did bring me oyster shells from my oyster
from
shell
Denmark.
Collection, so that was very nice.
Oh, terrific. Why do you have an oyster shell collection?
It's an ongoing... Oh, it's just such a big question.
Oh, God.
It's the idea of being able to eventually map out where oysters are slowly being regrown and regenerated in waters, and where also people have enjoyed and eaten them. So they come with stories of where they were harvested, where they're eaten, who ate them, and eventually, hopefully, they'll become an oyster map on a ceiling or somewhere.
Yeah. And on my birthday this year, my good friend Katrine Klinken, who is a chef as well and been here to New York with us, she's head of Slow Food in Copenhagen.
Okay.
She's been out the day before collecting oysters in the sea around the coast where we live. So she brought me a big box of the oysters she'd collected herself for my birthday party. That was really special. And I had to save the shells and bring them to New York and give them to Claire.
So eventually people will be able to read the stories that go along with the food, and it'll sort of, just in the beautiful ambiance and using light and shadow, hopefully then create an ambiance situation, you know, beautiful, but maybe for an interior, for a dirt cafe project.
I can't wait. Yeah.
It's like mapping a food story through the oysters.
Exactly. It's the whole story behind them. That is fascinating. So hopefully something to chew on next time, or slurping down oysters.
Yeah, save me some of your shells next time, Kathy.
yeah.
Love to if I had some. But, you know, speaking of oysters, I do love to ask everybody on the show a few questions. One in particular, speaking of oysters, romantic foods, so-called aphrodisiac foods, what do you guys think is like the best thing to cook on a date? Trina?
For me, that would be lobster and gnocchi in a chili sauce.
What? What is gnocchi?
Gnocchi, the Italian gnocchi.
Oh, gnocchi, lobster gnocchi with a chili sauce.
Yeah. That's my...
Spicy and succulent. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Good
and
idea.
And a really nice glass of champagne with that.
Okay, sparkling. I like it. That sounds good. How about you, Claire?
Oh, my goodness. I do love oysters. I'll just go with the oysters at this point. I think a really lovely thing was going out to the tip of the North Fork of Long Island, where I also had our wedding, and an oyster grower friend, Mike Osinski, took us out. We harvested wild seafood with him that were mussels and samphire, which is what Americans call sea beans, and also harvested some of his oysters and just cracked them all open in his kitchen, and we all sat around, and then, I mean, I don't know if that's so much romantic.
No, I love the activity behind it. You harvested them, and then there's nothing more satisfying than cracking open an oyster, too.
And just getting really close to the ocean and the sea and the smell of it, and then eating the food, that's really, it changes the way you remember the food forever.
Yeah, I my sister, she's a chef as well. She's, her name is Silla. And she has a few sushi restaurants in London. And she went to Africa, to a little island called Lamu.
Mm-hmm.
And she was actually teaching African chefs to do sushi down there.
Oh, wow.
And she went on a boat. And the guy who took her and her husband out, he just had a lemon in front. And she had no idea why he had a lemon. That was all there, a bottle of water and a lemon. And he took, they were, you know, sailing in this boat for like 45 minutes. And then he said, please sit on this little rock. And they sat on this little rock. And then he started diving. And he brought up oysters and gave them to them. And they just had the lemon and the oysters and were sitting there together. And she just, when she came back, she texted me, I've just been to the best Michelin restaurant in the world.
What else do you need?
Yeah.
A lemon and an oyster.
Okay, I think I thought of a romantic one. Okay. a little house, a little restaurant called Three Chimneys. It's on the northern end of the Isle of Skye. And no, but it reminds me of that directness that Scylla talked about. Yeah. And the chef at this tiny little restaurant that has maybe 10 tables said that everything comes within 10-mile radius of the restaurant, everything that she uses in the restaurant. But she said everything...
Forget 100 mile, 10 miles, next challenge.
And
I
she
like
said
that.
Everything that everything had changed for when the fishermen had gotten mobile phones because they could call in and the small catches and say, we've got this, this, and this, would you like that? And she said these kind of fun texting and relationships and calling back and forth started that wasn't there without the mobile phone. She would have had to go to the fish market. And...
It just
was so when we ate dinner there, we felt like we had benefited from this like rich interaction of people who had moved back to the Isle of Skye and had chosen to have their careers there, but weren't as isolated as they might have been socially.
That's incredible. And now I'm feeling very starved of these romantic eating experiences. I kind of go to North Fork or Scandinavia sometime really soon. Actually, I hope I will be. So where can we find out? We're just about out of time, unfortunately. But where can we find out more about your work, your upcoming, you know, writing about the garden? Is it going to be on your blog?
Yeah,
Trina?
It's going to mm-hmm. be on my website, which is trinahahneman.com.
.com. Yeah. Great.
So I will blog about it and hopefully if I can figure it out. I'm not that good with technology, but we'll see. And put small videos there from what my mother and I are doing.
Good luck with that.
Thank you very much.
That's so exciting. And I will be cooking your recipes in the meantime. This beautiful book.
Let me know what you think.
Send me an email. I will, definitely. And Claire, your dirtcandy.com or Dirt Cafe.
Dirt
sorry.
Cafe.
Well, what am I talking
it's not,
about?
There's not,
Dirt
it's not
Candy
very, it's
is
not
a
really
good
a,
name.
it's not really a public project, so I'm not sure people are going to find very much on it. It's a research project.
Mm-hmm.
But we are hoping to have some nice dinners in perhaps my garden as well as Jimmy's with
Great.
Trina when she comes back with the Nordic
diet
book and so that we can really explore that book more in the next year.
Yeah, that will be next year, but this fall we want to do a dinner about where we discuss some sustainable issues, and I'll cook up some really nice local food.
I would love to be there grating the horseradish otherwise.
And I think you're going to keep going with Jimmy
and the
Danish lunches at Jimmy's on weekends. Yep?
Yeah.
All right. Well, you can always stay tuned to Jimmy's blog then for more on these great projects and dinners and deliciousness. So thanks again so much, guys. I'm really, really excited to see what's going to happen next. It's about all the time we have here today. Today's show is brought to you by TechServe. We'll be back next week with Anna LaPay, author of Diet for a Hot Planet.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.